start this recorder. This is Lynn Johnson here with my dear friend Bruce Rawls, and we are the House of the Rising Sun, and the sun is rising this morning. It's just gorgeous. How about you, Bruce? What's going on with you?
I'm really good. Thanks, Lynn. And Well, the sun hasn't quite risen here yet, but it's on its way. And before we started this morning, I just happened to read a section in a book that I'm thoroughly enjoying, which I didn't even know about until it was kind of mentioned in an offhand remark by Judy Sketch Whitson's daughter, Tamara, that they had co-written. I may be up sitting in front of my computer, but I may not be fully awake here, just in the biological sense. But anyway, and I had the good fortune to meet with them and several of the other folks at the Foundation for Inner Peace yesterday, because I've been working on the website, and it was just, I always feel so welcome there, and we had a wonderful time. I was kind of scanning some of the images from the archives there, and also just enjoying a wonderful time to be together with those folks before I head back to Colorado. Anyway, that's kind of to preface this, but I wanted to let Judy and Tam know how much I've been enjoying their book. And so I wrote a little review on Amazon, and I'm just, I was about 2/3 of the way through. And then this morning I read a few more pages, before we started talking here. And, if you're fine with this, it's about 3 pages, and it's just really, really wonderful.
Just to let you guys know too, I think it's the 18th of September, the Community Miracle Center is having a fundraiser for the foundation, and Tamara and Bob Rosenthal are coming down, and so it's going to be really cool. It's up in San Francisco. At the Community Miracle Center. So please, if you have any thought or idea, or if you're in that area, go over and see those guys, because I'm telling you what, this is an amazing thing. And you may know this and you may not know this, Bruce, but there's been kind of a little kind of running feud. Not so much on the foundation part, but on the Community Miracle Center. Rep Tony has had some harsh thoughts about the foundation and the editing of the course, and has been very vocal about that, and been very vocal about a lot of issues that he particular and some other, there's a lot of other people who have those kind of issues. So the fact that right now they're going up to wherever it is that they are, the foundation, and going to have lunch with them, and then they're coming down to San Francisco or up to San Francisco or whatever for this fundraiser. This is, talk about the holiest spot on earth. You know, this is where, these grievances that we thought were so important can be just dropped and forgiven, and we can learn to partner with each other and join with each other because we have a shared purpose. And that's a miracle to me. That's a real miracle to me. And there's a couple other miracles that I'm waiting for. but that's one of the ones that I have had a great difficulty with over the years. Because, of course, I love the foundation, and I love the work that Ken did, and I love the work that Judy and those guys are doing. And I'm so defending. I want to defend them all the time. And, I don't have to do that, because this is the Holy Spirit's plan to bring us all back together. And so I'm very, very excited and pleased about this. But I'll get a link for the flyer so that y'all can see when and where that's going to be. And, I think, and Tamara's going to be there, and so is, Bob Rosenthal. So now press on.
Okay. Well, thank you for that as well.
Press on, Mr. Lee.
Oh. Thank you for that, Lynn. Yeah, because that really is an example of countless examples of how we go beyond special relationships with the form and transcend that to the content in our minds, which is where the forgiveness lies. So yeah, a great example. And I'm actually going to share another example from, the history of, two prominent course figures that is in Judy and Tam's book. And just to preface this, their book is called Double Vision, and by Judith Skutch and Tamara Cohen, both of whom have different last names now. So this is written a while ago, and when I asked Tam about this, she said, "Oh, that book," you know, kind of in sort of a dismissive voice, like, "Oh, that's nothing." But both of them write beautifully and eloquently about not only their personal history, but the how it ties into the birthing of this beloved course that we have all been studying. And anyway, if you haven't read it, it's highly recommended. I found a copy for a penny on Amazon with the usual $3.99 shipping, secondhand. And I started, you know, I mentioned it to my mom, who I've been staying with for almost a year now, and heading back in just about a week to Colorado. It's been great because I've actually been able to be over to visit the folks at Foundation for Inner Peace several times this past year. And anyway, but to set this up, this is from page 196, which is about three quarters of the way through the book, which is as far as I've gotten. And I just actually literally just read this morning, and it's like, wow, kind of right between the eyes. This just so brilliantly sums up the principles of the course with a wonderful example. So I'm just going to read this. The last little bit of setup on this is that this is the point in their life where they've lived in New York City, and Tam has gone off to college, and also her other sibling, and they're at a point where it's sort of Judy's empty nest syndrome kind of thing, and they're kind of at a point where you know, being guided to, okay, let's downsize and move somewhere, and so they're feeling, you know, the uncertainty and all that about that. And in the meantime, Judy has been doing has already gotten, you know, well into her sharing the course with people all over the planet, and her relationship with Jerry Jampolsky is part of the process that we all have, this, you know, similar process of looking at our special relationships. And this is just a brilliant account. And so I'm going to just, in part of this dialogue, this is one of the chapters that Judy wrote. They kind of take alternate turns writing a chapter or two at a time. And so, Judy is the author of this particular part of their double biography, which is called Double Vision. This is page 196. And, so they've just been talking about reincarnation. And then also, what else? Just kind of reflecting on, you know, some course principles. And, okay, so she's quoting Tamara saying, "Mom, is it true that the course says only one person is needed to save the world?" And that's the end of the quote. And then this narration goes on, and it says, this is Judy's voice now. "I expand on this idea, telling her the concept is that one holy, perfect teacher of God, whose learning is complete, can so touch other minds because of that person's recognition of his or her spiritual being and limitlessness that all other minds would instantly hold that thought. For, being one, we are so joined." Tammy digested that for a moment. And then this is Tammy's question again. "Mom, is that likely to happen soon?" And then Judy's response is, "I'm sorry to say, honey, that in what we know as time, it probably won't be." And then Tam's comment before Judy goes into this story is, "Well, that's a relief because I'm having so much fun here." Well, and isn't that the truth? True for all of us. I mean, we all think we're having so much fun here, or not, depending on, you know, which of ego's hot and cold, you know, switch positions we happen to be living in, right? You know, the euphoria or the phobia switch, right? So anyway, this is about three pages. But if you're okay with me reading this, Lynn, I'll just read this one. If you stop me anytime if you want to comment.
Please carry on.
Okay. Anyway, it's basically about. I'll just read it. You'll get the context. I was certain that the world was not likely to be saved by me in a hurry, as I was still trying to heal my relationships, especially with Jerry. And she's referring to Jerry Jampolsky here. Our friendship had deteriorated into a push-and-tug match to ascertain who was in control. Neither was winning. We knew we had to speed up the process and kept promising to relinquish the entire affair to Holy Spirit. But we slipped a lot. Does that sound familiar with anyone? Okay, then. All right, so we know we're all in the same boat here. We're all talking about the same process of needing to be compassionate. Okay, now back to Judy's writing.
So let me back up here. So,
sure.
So who was having a difficult relationship with Jerry?
Judy.
Jampolsky. Was it
Sam?
Judy.
No, Judy's talking about her relationship with Jerry, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. They got to be, you know, very close colleagues because they're both very actively, you know, sharing A Course in Miracles by this time. This is in the 70s, I believe. Okay. So, neither was winning. We knew we had to speed up the process and kept promising to relinquish the entire affair to Holy Spirit, but we slipped a lot. Helen focused her time with me on increasing my willingness to let go. One afternoon, as I was confiding my unhappiness, Helen queried, and this is a quote from Helen, "Do you have any idea of what your relationship with Jerry is for?" How's that for a setup question? Then Judy's response, "Yes, I do, Helen. It is so that I can understand the insanity of the ego and through my pain be better able to help others." And then Helen's response was, "Ridiculous. The Holy Spirit's lesson is that pain and suffering in any form are unnecessary." Isn't that great?
Okay. I love that. Yes.
Okay. And now she goes into another couple pages here. Thanks for your patience. That she goes into an episode that beautifully illustrates this. Okay. "I felt humiliated. Of course I had studied that. I just forgot it often." Sound familiar, anyone? Okay, that's my interjection, of course. "Somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew Jerry and I were engaged in a dance of, quote, specialness, unquote. I also sensed that this dear brother of mine really existed in my life so that I could come to understand the power of forgiveness. But I had nothing to forgive him for, and that is exactly the Course's teaching. Specialness begins with a misperception of ourselves as discrete from God. It is an insane dream. In that era of thinking, guilt is born. Guilt that we dared separate ourselves from our source. The special relationship is born out of the need to project that guilt onto someone else and so misdirect our thoughts away from God. I was keenly aware of that falling in love for me was an attraction to someone who seemed to have something I lacked. That person was my, quote, savior, unquote, and would make me complete. My feelings of love were not really love at all. I wanted something from that beloved other, and when the other did not continue to supply that scarcity in me, I was no longer in love. That much I had figured out for myself. What mystified me was that, quote, special love, unquote, should turn into, quote, special hate, unquote. The Course explained it perfectly to my satisfaction. We are not incomplete at all. How could a creation of God lack anything? To mistake another as needed to fulfill that which is already complete is indeed a major error. But to recognize the other as a mirror for yourself, to see in another being God's shining light, to expose our, quote, special hate, unquote, relationships as opportunities for forgiveness, then the, quote, enemy, unquote, can be seen as a blessed friend. In Jerry, I had the possibility of seeing that, quote, all the lamps of God were lit by the same spark, unquote. Bill Thetford was especially helpful to Jerry by reminding him of the meaning of forgiveness. Bill termed it celestial amnesia, which sounds like, you know, it could also tie into bliss and anyhood. That's just my comment. Okay.
It does, right. Yeah. Celestial amnesia. I like that. I think I'm going to use that.
Yeah, I like that a lot, too. Okay, then back to Judy's commentary. Remembering only love from the past and selectively discarding all the negative emotions. I reminded myself of Dr. William James's remark, quote, act as if and you will become, unquote. We tried so hard. Jerry tried harder than I. In fact, his powerful example of the desire to change constantly inspired me. He had made so many changes in his life already. He had been inner-directed to give up alcohol, and he did it cold turkey. He felt the need to eliminate coffee from his diet. I thought that would be more difficult, as I had watched him consume up to 22 cups a day. One evening, he visualized a steaming cup of coffee in his mind and told himself that he was not to drink it anymore. He stopped immediately. Jerry had shifted from an eclectic psychiatric practice to one based openly upon spiritual principles. This was not the same hyperkinetic man I had met in an airport a few years before. When we lectured together on our use of the Course, I saw people respond to him in a new way. He was lightening up, and it was more than physical. On a lovely spring weekend, Bill, Jerry, and I were attending a workshop on forgiveness in the Santa Cruz Mountains of California. We were the moderators, and I was feeling totally unforgiving. I, quote, acted as if, end of quote, as long as I could. My ego was giving me a monumental battle. Jerry had done nothing to deserve my rage. I couldn't pin it on anything at all, so I chose to dislike the way he was smiling. Finally, I broke away from the group, hiding my emotion, and ran into the woods. I felt as if I were wrestling with a dark side of me I had never truly known. It was horrifying. I wished my friend harm.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Thetford followed me into the woods. Dispassionately, but in full empathy, he put his arms around me and held me as I shook. Between spasms, I bared my soul. He smiled quietly offered, "You should rejoice." I turned, furious at him. Rejoice? How can I be happy when I'm so miserable and I don't even understand why? And then Bill's quoted here, "Rejoice because you wouldn't be experiencing such darkness if you weren't so close to the light." That was a quote from Bill. Yeah. Okay, Bill then suggested that my persistent and mounting rage at Jerry was in truth a projection of my own fear of the separation from God. It had nothing to do with Jerry at all. I was making him the butt to escape my own deep sense of guilt over a separation that had never occurred. I really didn't hear him, but I collected myself and huffily went off to moderate the next panel on forgiveness. When I approached the group, there was a refreshment pause, and people were milling around. I saw Jerry with a bandage over his eye. He had walked unseeing into an open metal cabinet door. He looked at me and said sadly, "Now are you happy, or would you like me to kill myself?" I was stunned at the nightmare we shared. I could hardly wait for the session to end. It had been a very black Sunday, which is the title of the chapter. Later that night, I was to give a talk about the Course to a group of students in Palo Alto. More than 100 had gathered for the occasion. I felt like a hypocrite. Still heavy at heart, I looked down at Bill and Jerry sitting in the audience as my support team and wondered how dishonest I could be. I heard the hostess introducing me in glowing terms. I didn't believe any of them. Now it was time for me to speak. I couldn't, I thought. I just couldn't. In desperation, I closed my eyes for a moment to shut out this horrific situation and suddenly remembered to call for help. It took only an instant to say to my internal teacher, "You take this mess. I can't hack it." When I opened my eyes, I gasped out loud. The room was filled with the most extraordinary light. For a puzzling moment, I thought the light shining on me. Get a little emotional just reading this.
Yeah, this is amazing. Me
it's,
too.
It's great. For a puzzling moment, I thought the light shining on me was for televising the talk. I heard someone from the back ask the custodian, "Will you please turn that light lower?" There was no external source to the laser-like ray. And then it was gone, and I was left blinking to my surprise. But oh, that feeling, released, refreshed, and rejoicing, thanking the world and everyone in the room with a fierce gratitude I had never known. I looked down at Jerry, and he knew. He was beaming pure love at me. I gave my speech. They liked it. Jerry came up to me as everyone was crowding around sharing stories, and I waited until I was alone. He whispered softly, "Thank God it's over." We held hands with tears of joy brimming to the surface of our enlightened eyes. It was the beginning to the end of specialness. Bill suggested that we open our text to page 448. Together we read out loud, "This holy relationship, lovely in its innocence, mighty in strength, and blazing with a light far brighter than the sun that lights the sky you see, is chosen of your Father as a means for his own plan. Be thankful that it serves yours not at all. Nothing entrusted to it can be misused, and nothing given it but will be used. This holy relationship has the power to heal all pain, regardless of its form. Neither of you alone can serve at all. Only in your joint will does healing lie. For here your healing is, and here you will accept atonement. And in your healing is the sonship healed, because your wills are joined." Isn't that wonderful?
That is just amazing. And it, there's a couple things about that story. Is that as far as you're going to read?
That was the end of the excerpt that I wanted. That was the end of that chapter. So
that is an amazing story. Mm-hmm. And a couple things that really struck me. One is that when she ran into the woods, Bill followed her, and Bill did not say, you know, "Look at your thoughts, look at this. He said, you know, this is just your feelings separated from God.
Right, right.
This is it. You're just feeling separated from God.
Which isn't necessarily recommended in many relationships to be that direct, but obviously they'd both been studying the Course, and so it was appropriate, very appropriate at that moment, you know, evidently, yeah. So.
And that's, I think, you know, amongst us, amongst people who are Course in Miracles students, I think that for the most part, for all parts, once someone has committed to be a student of the Course, and that's not really their choice, it comes at the time when it's supposed to be here, we can be honest with each other. We don't have to pussyfoot around and go through your psychological profile and, you know, what did your parents do to you when you were a kid, or why do you feel so unworthy because you dropped your toy and your parent didn't pick it up for you or whatever. We can go straight to, "Hey, dude, it's because you're feeling separated from God." Yeah. There's one cure for that.
Yeah. It's still very important to be sensitive to not necessarily, like you say, the persona and our interpretation of what that person may be going through, but it be alert and listening to our, you know, metaphoric inner kindness teacher's voice as to, you know, what to do and what to say.
Exactly.
because the form may vary wildly, but the content, if the content is one of there is no guilt in God's Son, then you know, the form will take care of itself, and we'll know what to say and what to do, and may involve saying something Course related if a person is familiar with the Course and we feel there's a deep understanding and an appreciation that, you know, it won't be taken the wrong way, then that may be appropriate. But in many cases, I think it could very easily be inappropriate, especially if it's coming from a place of lack or specialness in ourselves. And I think that is, again, what the whole point of this was to look at, you know, when we are coming from a place of special interests, of separate interests, and thinking that there's something specific that is making us happy or unhappy, because we're making the dream real in that moment, and
right.
we've dropped the hand of our inner kindness teacher in that moment.
Exactly, and we're looking at to a figure in the dream for some kind of, you know, whatever it is that we're looking for, and there's no figure in the dream that's going to be able to provide you with to fill the hole that feels so empty. Because you feel disconnected from your source. So, you know, that's why we join, is so that, you know, we can see that. And so she had that epiphany. And so when this occurred and she was on the stage and she opened her eyes and she saw the light, other people saw the light too.
Go ahead.
That's amazing. I mean,
yeah. Well, it's only because all minds are joined. I mean, how could it be otherwise? When I heal my mind, I realize that all other minds are healed too. And I think that ties into, I'm not sure if it was a conversation I was having with you last week or someone else, but, you know, this past week, but it's kind of like I had this, which I've had, you know, and I get now and then is when I need to remember this, is that, you know, I don't need to wait for anything else in the universe to change. I mean, it's really totally my decision as to when I will, you know, accept the atonement for myself. And that's I think the Course comes out of that in so many ways. You know, the sole responsibility for the miracle worker is to accept the atonement for themselves. And that's what it comes down to, isn't it? Because there's nothing that needs to happen in a dream for a person to wake up.
Yeah.
How could that possibly be? So if I think that, oh, if I wake up, or if I'm having too much fun here, to tie into this story, or if I think that, you know, there's something that I need to resolve in the world, no, it's all in the mind. It's only in the mind. And when I wake up, I will discover everyone there has, you know, been there all along, and metaphorically, the seeming others, just waiting like Maytag repairmen for me to get with it, you know? and I think that's kind of helpful, you know? It's like, oh, okay. But it doesn't mean that we need to be difficult with ourselves. You know, it actually encourages extreme patience. But that patience is really, ironically, what propels us further along. And as the celestial speed up that is our own personal, you know, journey back to source, you know, that we all seem to have different paths with, but it's all the same trajectory, right?
Exactly. And you just made me think too about this thing that people do, that, you know, is, kind of popular, I guess. I hear about it a lot anyway, is this inner child work.
Uh-huh.
People are doing this inner child work. And what really is that doing? You know, what really I think you're doing is you're just accepting yourself.
Uh-huh.
You're just accepting yourself for what appears to be, and recognizing that you're not really responsible for the persona that is being projected into the world. You know, I'm not responsible for what this Lynn character is. And, you know, I go through my life thinking that I am responsible for the character, the being, the body, the mind, all the things that are done through and by this character Lynn. And when I think that somehow I'm the one who's moving things and making things happen, instead of that I'm the one who's observing the replay of something that happened long ago that never had any actual effect, and that which was over in less than a moment, not a note in heaven's song was missed. And yet every scenario that's happening or appears to be happening in this dream was made at that time. So the character Lynn was made then. The words I'm saying now were made then. Everything that's happening now was made at that very instant and is gone, over, done.
Uh-huh.
And so the idea then that any character in the dream or any thought in the dream can change that is ridiculous. And
yeah, it is, isn't it? I mean, it's totally ludicrous, but we've kind of like going to a movie or in a dream, you know, that we're masters at the suspension of disbelief. You know, we've so thoroughly convinced ourselves that that this massive hologram that we call arrogantly and mindlessly reality. I mean, what a farce. What a farce. But we need to start with where we think we are. Because we've bought into it so thoroughly, we need to address it as if it were real and bring all of our interpretations to the Holy Spirit, to our inner kindness teacher, and say, hey, here's what I'm thinking, and that's exactly what Judy did here. Says, I'm not going to deal with this as Judy. Bruce and Lynn are not going to deal with this as Bruce and Lynn. They're hopeless. We're all hopeless as seemingly separate selves. But when we, you know, turn it over to that inner kindness teacher, it's like, okay, well, amazingly enough, and it doesn't always necessarily fix the dream in the way that our egos would like the dream fixed either. But it always fixes the dream. Exactly.
You can't fix it. It's done. It's over long ago. So you can't change it. All you can do is change your mind about it.
Right. But what happens, though, is that it does heal our interpretation. Because we let go of the interpretation, and then the healing that's behind that happens automatically. And people notice that because I think that's why in several accounts, that people didn't like to look at Jesus because, you know, he represented a love that they couldn't deal with. And I think that's a quality that we need to look at as far as our resistance is that, you know, our special relationships take time to heal because we're so afraid of the love that's behind the special love and the special hate. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. We don't need to beat ourselves or anyone else up for indulging in that, but just kind of look at it with a tremendous gentleness and compassion and in ourselves and in each other. Yeah,
exactly. And it's natural for the ego to be afraid of the thing that's going to, make it no longer exist. And in fact, the ego's job is to continue its existence and to continue to fool us with the matrix. And that's its job, you know, and when it has no job, it's going to be, it's worried, you know, it's going to be dead. It's not going to be alive anymore. And all of its special functions are going to be gone because they're going to be being done by, the Christ mind, which doesn't, need a structure. And the structure is only necessary because of keeping the matrix going.
Yeah.
So, of course, we're going to be afraid of giving that up because if you're walking, I think China has this glass bridge that goes.
I saw a video on that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it goes across this really high, like precipice, like maybe up in Canyon City, what is it? Anyway.
Oh, right, that one, yeah.
The Royal Gorge or something.
Right,
so
right.
So people go across this glass bridge, and, you know, it's terrifying because it appears that...
Where's my support?
You have no support. You have no support. Uh-huh. But that's what this is. It's like, you know, there is no bridge. We can actually step out like Indiana Jones with the, when he scattered the sand and saw the bridge.
Much better analogy than Roadrunner. Yeah. Wile E. Coyote.
Yes, exactly.
Those only last for a second or two until they slip back into the ego can't do it thinking, right?
Exactly. But when you have to just take that leap of faith and just say, you know, okay, I'm going to imagine that it's possible that I can be without this support system that seems so vital to me. Mm-hmm. I can imagine that if I could just let the Holy Spirit take hold of things and do whatever is going to be, because it's going to be done no matter what. It's going to happen no matter what because it's part of the script. But the fear, the thought that I could change it somehow, that there's something that I could do to make it different, that brings about so much fear because, hey, if I can change the script, then we're all in deep shit. Excuse my language. But I can't. But the fear that I can't, it's all these fears that the ego is pointing out to you that, you know, if you look behind that curtain, your world is going to be destroyed. You know, you know, Truman go across the ocean and climb up that little stairs and his world is destroyed.
That's
going to happen. And the ego knows that. Yeah. So, it doesn't want to destroy the world. It really wants to keep it. And so, you know, it's going to throw up all kinds of barriers.
Right, and, right. And the insanity, of course, is that we're never truly happy in the ego's thought system. And I think that's why, you know, like in the Truman Show that you were just alluding to, that, you know, the floodlight falls down from the big, you know, the huge soundstage ceiling that's painted to look like sky and crashes in front of Truman, a.k.a. Jim Carrey. And he says, what? What's that? You know, and everybody says, pay no attention, you know, to that, well, metaphoric man behind the curtain, right? But yeah, mixing theatrical metaphors.
I love it, though.
But yeah, but that's just it. I mean, we get to a point where we realize I'm not happy in this thought system. We keep coming back and back, you know, again and again to the idea that, well, I can fix the dream. I think I can fix this dream, you know. And that's the ego's, you know, gasp, last gasp. We're really in the last gasp. I mean, it may take lifetimes, but we're in the last gasp of trying to make the ego work for us. And I think that we're drawn to A Course in Miracles and that understanding because we recognize there's got to be a better way. And what you were alluding to about the inner child a few moments ago, Len, it kind of reminds me of Lesson 182 in the workbook where, you know, as Ken points out in his commentary on it, is so brilliant that I've listened to hundreds of times now because it's on my iTunes and I listen on my Bluetooth. Anyway, that basically is such a great reminder that it we're all like little kids, you know, wanting to go home and just for the breath of that fresh air from, you know, the Father's house, you know, that we know that there's a better way. And that's why we continue to be drawn back to this after bouts of resistance and fighting it and, you know, trying to make our special love-hate relationships work and realizing, no, that's not it. It's got to be beyond both of those to get to the real love, the love that doesn't change. And we know we're, you know, that's inevitable, but, you know, we're foot draggers. And so this is the course in removing the tie downs from our inner airplane so that we can get this thing off the ground, you know?
Exactly. And we're doing that footstep, foot dragging.
yeah.
But when we remember, like Judy did, remember that, you know, it's the Holy Spirit that's in charge of this. You know, I don't have to worry about what to say or do. And just close your eyes. You don't have to close your eyes. Just go still. Just go still and ask, you know, help me. Sometimes I just do that. Help me, help me, help me. And because I have the same thing. There are some people sometimes that, you know, even come in here and, you know, I'm listening to them and they're saying things that I don't like. And I'm thinking, you know, this guy is a jerk. And, you know, I'm going through that whole thing. And I'm actually literally, you know, wanting to kill somebody.
How dare him be part of the People's Front of Judea? I'm part of the Judean People's Front, right?
Exactly. So when I'm looking at this, that's all I can do is ask for help because I'm helpless. Of myself, I can do nothing and I'm helpless. And I know that the more I protest and the angrier I become or the more I allow the grievance to continue, the more painful it becomes. And it's so painful that, you know, it gets to the point where I just don't even want to see this person or hear this person again. And, you know, in that place, I've literally, in my mind, I've murdered them. You know, I've like taken them out. You know, this person is no longer a part of my life. I don't want to hear from them again. And, you know, that's happened to me with a lot of people. It happened to me with Teddy Poppy. And, you know, I had a tremendous healing with Teddy because I realized that, you know, it was just it's too painful and started doing Ho'oponopono, which is a way, it's the same thing, forgiveness. You know, it is exactly the same thing. You know, you recognize, you know, that, you know, you love the person, you love the being that they are, and you forgive them for what you think they did, but you also want to forgive yourself for believing that they're not me. And so I did that with him for a long time. It took a long time. It wasn't just a one thing like with Judy there. it took me time after time after time after time.
A slow burn.
Yeah, it was a slow burn thing. And eventually, you know, I was, and eventually, when all my objections were gone, when I had no more, nothing more to object to about him, there was nothing that bothered me about him. It was like suddenly I'm just totally love the person. It's like my heart just opened up, cracked open like Judy was talking about. And I was just filled with great, great love. And now there's, I don't think there's anything that Teddy could do that would ever upset me ever again. That's pretty amazing.
That's great. That's great. That's great. Yeah. And it's just another example of how we, you know, like you were saying earlier, you know, the place where an ancient hatred has become a present love is, you know, metaphorically one of the holiest spots on earth, you know, because that's where we've taken our special hate love, you know, class, you know, prison and turned it into a classroom with again, only with a change of thought system. And that's the only way it ever works.
It's the only way it works. And it works. I mean, that's the thing that's so amazing. Is once something has been healed through that, it really is healed. And, you know, it may come up again in another form, because maybe there's another, you know, there's always going to be an exception. As long as I look out and I see a world, and I look out and I see a person, and I look in the mirror and I see a person, as long as there is that going on in my mind, I'm going to have some kind of objection to it. That's the way the ego works. The ego just says, all that's not good, and it's all going to hurt you. So, you know, be careful, be cautious, don't get too close. I was going to also, here's, I don't know if it was a miracle, I have no idea, really, just a technical glitch, but it was very funny that happened last night. I was talking about Teddy. Teddy was in the room, and we were having our festive Friday, and I was talking about my relationship with Teddy and how that shifted, and Pal Talk went down. Pal Talk went down and kicked everybody out of the room. And but I could see because I have my
X-ray vision.
Yeah, because I have this radio computer over here that sends out the signal to Shoutcast.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that as I was still talking, the signal was still going, mm-hmm. and everybody was kicked out of Pal Talk. And I was still talking, the signal was still going, and Teddy was messaging me saying, Pal Talk is down, but I hear you talking. And other people were saying, when Pal Talk went down, I could still hear you talking. I heard the whole story. People just, I heard the whole story, and then it ended. It was like, how did that happen? You know, and then we were like speculating, well, maybe we're just getting that joined.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really cool. It's sort of like, you know, the minds are joined, but the form really gives, you know, the specifics give form to the decision in the mind, isn't it? I mean, that's what it comes down to. Huh?
Exactly. And you know, it's like, you know, how does this network work? How does this internet, how does the really, honestly, there's no reason any of it should work. I mean, it's all, it could be cardboard boxes in front of us. And if we believed that that was a communication device and we were communicating to each other, that's what would be happening.
Yeah. It really is, you know, because, you know, if there's no order of difficulty in miracles, then anything in the dream that seems to affect something else in the dream is just silly, right? But we're so conditioned to think that, well, this can only happen with this, and that can only be the cause of that, and yada yada, and yeah, it's just all smoke and mirrors.
But, yeah. I know what things are for.
Yeah, so we have magical relationships with science and so-called objectivity, and it goes on and on. But that's okay. I mean, you know, and I take vitamins and try to exercise, and you know, we all have these magic things, and you know, why not do those things if it helps us ease gently out of fear and do it at a pace that we're comfortable with? There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, so you know, if you you know, lapse into paranormal stuff, which this book I just read from, by the way, it goes into quite a bit and is fascinating. with a tip of the hat to Tam and her patience with all of that. But we make such big deals out of the specialness of you know, things that seem magical, you know. But if all minds are joined, then how could we not know everything about everyone? It's only in our arrogance that we don't know the truth, and then everything else that's ephemeral that comes and goes. Well, we could know that too, but it's not really knowing. That's just, you know, that's just,
it's the whole part of the dreamscape.
Yeah, exactly. Or the goatscape, if we're using ego's interpretation of it.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and in that dreamscape, don't depreciate the imagination of the Son of God.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
In that dreamscape, when that tiny magic idea occurred, it didn't just make one little world where, few billion humans over, you know, times. It made, I mean, billions of things, because there's infinite creative ability. The Son of God has infinite creative ability. So if you could think, and you could think right now of any scenario, it could be anything. It could be a pleasant thing. It could be a hideous thing. Whatever it is, all that is in the script.
Mm-hmm.
Even the thought that you could think of it, it must be in the script. It can't be something you just made up, because we cannot continue to miscreate. We had one instant of miscreation,
mm-hmm.
and that was it. And that didn't even really happen.
Right.
It was all in a dream. So
yeah.
We can't continue to make more and more and more and more and more dream. That dream was already there. All we're doing is accessing that page, you know, the page that says, you know, starve and kill millions of Jews, or the page that says, go to the moon. All we're doing is looking through a story.
Mm-hmm.
And every scenario that could be is in that story. And we can access it with any part of it. It's like accessing a part of your brain. We can access any of it. That's why the dream can shift. It seemed like maybe we're going into a nicer dream, but really we're just shifting. We're collapsing time. We're skipping chapters and going into another part. It's still the dream. It's still the same dream, but it's just maybe a more pleasant part of the dream. And that's when Jesus talks to us about the real world even. That is still the dream. It's just a more pleasant part of the dream where we're not in fear.
Right, right. And that's a shorter step across to what's beyond the reality we think of as, you know, the real world. Yeah, yeah. Hey, can I make one more little digression, since you've been so patient with me already this morning, just to tie into what
absolutely.
You just said?
Absolutely. Well, I've been digressing too, so hey.
Okay. Well, of course, this entire space-time cosmos is a digression, but that kind of ties into what I'm about to say, which is when you mentioned, things being far away, somehow that something you said triggered that, and I was remembering a nocturnal dream that I had years ago, where I think I was studying astrology quite a bit at that time. This is, you know, a few decades ago, and I remember having this dream where the planets were just really close, and they looked huge in the sky. And I remember it was a daytime episode in this dream, where I could look up and sometimes, you know, obviously you can see the moon during the day when it's, the lighting is right and so forth. But I remember seeing Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune and Mars and, you know, some of those kind of planets. But they were like really close, you know. I mean, obviously in this so-called world, the tidal forces would have been ripping the planet apart, you know, with that kind of thing. In the dream, how dreams are, it's a suspension of disbelief again. Well, in thinking about that, I was kind of like, kind of tying into that episode in the Truman Show movie where the light falls from the sky and the galaxies that seem far away really are actually pretty close in that soundstage, right, and of our mind and this little Whoville dream that we're having. And it kind of reminded me that things I've I've read that makes sense, that, you know, if space-time really is an illusion, then the galaxies that seem far away, and modern physics corroborates this, of course, with the quantum entanglement that suggests that no matter how far you put two pairs of paired electrons, for example, their axis of spin will synchronize instantaneously. You know, not at the speed of light or millions of speed times the speed of light. It's instantaneous. So it's like, okay, well, if that's true, then our whole notion of space-time is just bogus. And if our true being is outside of space and time, then that gives us tremendous hope in reality, because then we don't have to fix anything in the dream. And there's nothing to fix here. But our choice for which thought system. And that's, I think, what our beloved course continues to remind us at every turn.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, it's not rocket science. You know, that the course is not. I mean, it's not rocket science.
It
has nothing to do with any sort of mechanism or anything. It really is just knowing that there is nothing outside of me.
Right.
And so then that must expand my perception of me to be much more than what I think it is, because I think everything is outside of me. And if everything is inside of me, and of course, you know, this dream, it really is just a projection of a thought in my mind. It doesn't even have a physical, real physical existence, because the tiny man idea was not capable of having a true effect. It could only have an illusory effect. So, you know, this idea of what is real is really, again, it's in my mind. It's my own thinking, but it's all inside of me is a very, if you look at it correctly, is a very mind blowing and expanding thought. Because that means that I'm much bigger than I think I am. I'm much more than I think I am.
But certainly not as the little less self that we think we are. You know, what the Course, I think, has us do is gently relinquish our identification with that dysfunctional, separated self, and by doing exactly that, which is to look at all of our beliefs in separation, all the things that where we don't want to share the interest of another as our own in truth, and where we have grievances and issues and the whole gamut of special love, special hate, and resistance, and just look at all that stuff and say, wow, that's just silly. It's just silly. And that is basically the barrier to the awareness of love's presence that I'm keep dredging out of my mind and putting in front of that love, so that I don't feel I deserve it. And that kind of ties into the FAQ. Do we have time to read that?
We do have time. We have till the bottom of the hour. So
okay. Well, I was thinking FAQ number 1213, kind of shifting over from Foundation for Inner Peace to the Foundation for A Course in Miracles now, and the contributions that these two sister organizations have made for us is just phenomenal, isn't it?
It is amazing, and what a great foundation.
Yeah.
So,
do you want to read the question?
Yeah, and I'm pasting the link in the room.
Okay,
so,
great.
1213, 1213, excuse me. All right, I understand that our interpretation of things must change, but that outer conditions won't necessarily change as a result. Yet I also understand, in the cinema analogy, that what we see cannot be different from what the film in our minds projects onto the screen of our experience. I also understand that concern with how long the shift of purpose in a relationship takes, and I believe this refers to perceived results of that shift, is of the ego. So this is kind of a convoluted little question here. Because, you know, they're saying, yeah, I see that, you know, I need to change my interpretation of the things, but the world is not going to change necessarily because of that. But we can only see what we're actually projecting, which is just what we were just talking about. You only actually see what you're projecting. Uh-huh. And you know, we're talking about, you know, if this is what I'm projecting, maybe the perceived results might take some time. Nevertheless, the course does hold out the eventuality of the quote-unquote happy dream, which is what we were just talking about. Does that occur only when the ego ceases to want it? Why do specific patterns, that's a good question. Why do specific patterns exist in our personal dreams? Is there a simple answer to why it takes time for changes to appear? If they ever do, since they are supposedly reflections of consciousness and the miracle of conscious reorientation takes no time. See, now there is a question that is based on one misinterpretation.
Uh-huh. That we believe time is real, and so it kind of distills down to, why ain't I happy?
Yeah, exactly. And when will I be happy?
Right.
Why am I not happy, and when will I be happy?
Uh-huh.
And will the world change because of it? And let's see, what was it that, nevertheless, the course does hold out the eventuality of the happy dream. Does that occur only when the ego ceases to want it? And I'm assuming that they're, I'm not sure what the ego is ceasing to want other than the world and life and to maintain the status quo. Why do specific patterns exist in our personal dreams? Well, here's to me the big deal. We don't have personal dreams.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a personal dreamscape here.
Right.
There is one shared ego, one shared mind, and so none of it is a personal dream. So it
seems to be otherwise. I mean, we have tremendous evidence within both our sleeping and so-called waking states to the contrary, but it's just a massive, incredibly high production value holographic dream. It's a theatrical production of unimaginable proportions that gives us the impression that my dream could be separate or different from your dream. And wow, what a wild trip it's been, is it?
Well, and you know, it seems remarkable when you look at it and you go, oh, wow, this is fabulous, like you were saying. It's amazing. But it's only set up to meet the expectation that we have of it.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
It's exactly what we, it could be the worst junk in the, perceived galaxy, universe, whatever. It could just be total trash. And in fact, compared to reality, it is. But we see it as, oh, wow, this is so cool, because it's set up to meet our expectation of whatever it is that we think we want. So, of course, it's going to seem really cool or really awful, depending on what you expect. But is there a simple answer as to why it takes time for changes to appear, if they ever do, since they are supposedly reflections of consciousness? That's the change. It's like Judy. Her perception changed. Nothing else. Jerry didn't change. Bill didn't change. Nothing else changed. It was just her perception.
Right.
So it didn't change the external world, but it changed it for her, because that was what she was willing to see.
Exactly. So,
and it does take no time. It is an instant. And that doesn't mean you couldn't be in the middle of a war zone. You know, that doesn't mean you couldn't be being beheaded. You know, if you can change your thinking to recognize that none of it is really happening, and it's all, you're just being shown the effect, the potential effect, if it were possible that it was real. And, you know, if you're believing it, then you've done a good job of fooling yourself. Otherwise, you know, if you don't believe it, you can just look at it and laugh. And that's what happens.
And the laughter is so helpful. I mean, we don't have to necessarily laugh out loud, but you know, as you were talking about earlier, and it kind of tied into something I've always enjoyed of Ken Wapnick's commentary about, you know, when we slog out of bed and drag ourselves to the bathroom mirror, and if we identify with the reflection there, we know that we're taking it too damn seriously, because it is the appropriate reaction is hysterical laughter, you know, at what we see, because we're taking one little speck that is not, doesn't even register on the cosmic radar, and taking that as our whole dream drama, you know, focus, and talk about getting things distorted and out of perspective, right? Well, how about if I go ahead and read the first paragraph of the answer, this FAQ number 1213. And
this is short, too. We don't have a lot of paragraphs, so I think we
Might actually get through it, huh? Okay. The only meaningful change that can take place is the decision to choose against the ego and for the atonement, the undoing of the belief in separation. The, quote, happy dream, unquote, spoken of in A Course in Miracles flows from this choice and pertains only to one's inner experience or perception. It has nothing to do with what our eyes see, the seemingly real external world. It is natural in our separated state to want things to go well in our lives, in the world, whatever that may mean. But as we work more and more with the Course, we learn that the source of true happiness and peace is our decision to forgive, which means that we would increasingly see our interests as the same as everyone else's. This is the happy dream, where our joy comes not from anything external, but from the internal awareness that we have been mistaken about the world and who we are, and that the truth is that we all share the same interests, and ultimately, the same identity as God's one Son.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That pretty much says it all there. And again, you know, if you're expecting the war to end, or you're expecting the global warming to be done, or you're expecting anything externally in the dream, then you're never going to have a happy dream, because you're looking to something that doesn't exist to feed you, to support you. And, you know, the fact that it's not real, it doesn't exist, and it is misdirecting us from the truth and the reality, which is the relationships that we have with our brothers, who are ourselves and reflection of what, you know, our own truth. And when those relationships are repaired, it doesn't matter what happens in the world. You know, it doesn't matter if you're in dire poverty. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, about to be executed. Doesn't matter. Any of those things don't matter if you are, if your relationships with yourself, your brothers, and God are all the same, and that you're not seeing any differences or having any fear based on those relationships, then it doesn't matter what's happening. You're going to be in joy.
Now you're describing what would be called a more advanced state with the context of those situations. However, you know, in truth, that's you know, what you just shared is very true. And on a practical level, though, we need to be very patient with ourselves and give ourselves plenty of slack when we find our resistance too strong. And of course, it says, you know, do not fight yourself. And that's basically saying, you know, when you see your investment in the ego is more predominant than your investment in our inner kindness teacher's, you know, undoing curriculum, just to say, okay, all right, so for this moment, and it could be a lifetime, or it could be, you know, days, weeks, and years even, you know, that we, you know, indulge in that specialness classroom, and but think of it as a prison, you know, within that paradigm, and it's like, okay, well, but that has had no effect on the reality. And that's, I think, where that the forgiveness classroom then kicks in, is when we, you know, give ourselves the time and are patient with whatever pace is in our script to just watch that and see that everyone is in that same process of undoing, that there's no exceptions, and we're all included in the perfect innocence that we never left. And that I think is what we're all wanting to remember. Do you want to read the next paragraph?
Yes, I'm going to read the next one.
Okay.
And I was just going to say, that's why, you know, the whole thing from Philo or Plato or whoever said it, be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle.
That's
absolutely true. If that's all you could do was just be kind,
Right.
And recognize that, you know, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It really does change. It does shift. So
it does.
Go ahead with the next paragraph then.
Sure, okay. Sometimes this shift in awareness is reflected externally because when we let go of guilt, we will no longer act in hurtful ways toward ourselves and others. For example, if I have been engaged unconsciously in a specialness bargain or a victim-victimizer bargain with another person, that other person may change when I choose to no longer uphold the bargain. But you have to be careful not to make judgments based on form, appearances in the world. We do not see our own or anyone else's full path, or best interests, I might add. And so we cannot judge why lessons appear as they do. It could be that some people have chosen to learn through ongoing physical or psychological suffering. That may be their path. We don't know that, so we should not attempt to draw conclusions about their spiritual progress on the basis of the external patterns and conditions. And, you know, we look at, you know, examples of how our senses deceive us in the world of optical illusions and science shows how, you know, for example, the magic eye posters where you can look past it and see a three-dimensional pattern if you shift your eyes focus just a little bit beyond the printed page, and wow, there's this, you know, all these three-dimensional shapes are showing up, but there's nothing there. But in a sense, there's nothing in the two-dimensional
world either. Illusion.
It's all illusion, but that's just kind of a fun metaphor, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We do actually see things differently, or I do anyway. I do see things differently when I'm willing to, just recognize. Well, again, I go back to that prime directive. It's none of my business where you are. It's none of my business your spiritual evolution, or, you know, whether or not you see the truth, or whether or not you're willing to let go of your ego. That's not up to me. I have nothing to do with that. And I have to assume, as we are one mind and we are one being, that we all want the same thing. We all have the same need, and we are all doing the work to get to where it is that, you know, we want to be or we truly are. So, you know, how can I look at you and say, well, you're missing the mark. I don't have any, there's nothing to compare.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
The only way that you can see that somebody's doing something wrong or different is if you're comparing one thing to another. There's nothing to compare because we're all perfect and doing exactly what we're here to do. And we're on the timeline that is not my timeline. I didn't make it up. And I mean, ultimately I did, but the reality of it is we're all waking up. We're all doing the same thing, and we're all in the same place, and nobody is any different, separate. You know, I don't care if you are, you know, a witch doctor or, Dr. Billy Graham, you know, either way, you're the same as me.
Mm-hmm.
We're not different. So
exactly.
Shared vision, shared needs, and everybody is doing exactly what they signed up for. And the whole purpose is for us to eventually recognize it's a play. It's not me. I'm the actor. I'm not the character.
Mm-hmm.
And neither are you. And therefore, there's no reason for me to hold against you the thing that the character does.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because it's just characters in a play. A few moments ago, something you said triggered a reminder of something that I found kind of a fun mnemonic device that uses the numerical numbers 2 and 4. And I used to, I think I put this in my first or my second book, actually, the cut our effort in half by being responsible to each other instead of for each other. which is kind of like saying, okay, if I'm responsible to you, that means I'm looking at the contents of my mind and the ego's proclivity for projection, and just saying, oh, well, you know, gently when we catch ourselves doing that, it's like, oh, reel it back in. It's this is my projection that I'm responsible. I'm responsible for my own thoughts. And what you think of me is none of my business, basically. And that takes a load off, you know. That really cuts the effort way down of thinking that, well, I need to be concerned about what anyone else thinks or does or says or whatever. And it's just what's going through my mind that is the sole determiner of whether I'm happy or not, isn't it?
Exactly. And it's a responsibility for sight, not for, it's not responsibility for the action. It's not responsibility for the character. It's not responsibility for any part of the dream.
Exactly.
It's responsibility for how I see. The world I see is my responsibility.
Yep.
And a lot of people get confused about that and say, well, you know, it means that I need to change things. I need to do something different. It's not what you do. It's what you see. And, you know, I love that Jesus is, you know, you can get confused and think that, you know, somehow or the other, I'm in the business of changing the dream. But, you know, when you really look at it, what Jesus is saying, you're not responsible to change the dream. You're responsible to change your mind about the dream.
Yep. We're all in his recovering dream repair technician classroom, aren't we?
Exactly. So let me go on to the next paragraph.
Okay.
Let's see. So we've just said that we can't draw conclusions about people's spiritual progress on the basis of external patterns and conditions. You know, we don't know. And
right.
So it is fairly common for people to experience specific recurring patterns in their lives, such as rejection, abandonment, abuse, or failure, for example. We all have a deeply repressed layer of guilt over our belief that we rejected God and our identity as his son, having thrown away our inheritance of eternal love and peace. The overwhelming guilt over that and the subsequent fear of punishment causes us to project responsibility for this quote-unquote sin, which means we would always be seeking to blame someone else for it. Thus, in order to deflect the blame for my rejecting God and love, I would experience myself as being the innocent victim of other people's insensitive rejection of me. So until I am open to the idea of projection, when I can actually say I'm the one who's making that story up, and then can look at my own guilt with Jesus or the Holy Spirit, I will have the unconscious need to be an innocent victim. Quote unquote, it's not my fault will be my theme song, and I will have no awareness of the origin of this recurring pattern. And that is the shield of oblivion that says, I am not going to look at this. I feel it's guilt and it's hurting, so I'm not going to look at it. I'm just going to bury it, but it's going to keep coming up. Because I'm going to have the same experience over and over and over until I actually look at and see the cause of the experience. Not the cause of the things that happened in the dream, but the cause of my experience of the things that are happening in the dream.
Very good point. Very good point. And that ties, like you said, that ties into the double shield of oblivion that the Course refers to in Lesson 136. That, you know, it's really everything in space-time. The entire, you know, individuality, space, time, that whole gamut of stuff, anything that involves any of those is basically part of that propaganda machine that the ego put in place to keep us mindless, and it's foolproof, but it's not God-proof because we are minds and we can choose to go beyond that outer shield, where we're firefighting all the time and you know, penetrate as well the inner shield of oblivion, which is the sin, guilt, fear paradigm, by looking at the crazy stuff that goes through our minds when we're divorced from our Holy Spirit's counsel, and just look at that and see, wow, that just obviously is not making any sense. If I go beyond that, then that's where the peace kicks in, because we realize that none of that makes any sense and we can really let go of it. That's our forgiveness process. Yeah. So, shall I read the last paragraph?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, last paragraph.
We might finish before the end of the half hour. It cannot be said too often that a favorite ego lure is judging according to form, and that is why the lessons in A Course in Miracles are exclusively about the content in our minds. The early lessons especially are helping us to see that the inner and outer are the same. That is hard for us to relate to, for it reverses what we have learned in the world. Progress in this course rests on our openness to seeing our lives in the world as the result of the choices we make in our minds. And we always make one of the only two choices available to us, to perceive everything in terms of ego's thought system of separation, or in terms of the correction of that, the Holy Spirit's thought system of forgiveness. So
that's it.
Yeah, that's what a great summary, huh?
It is a great summary. It is, and just not falling for it. Now, Markman writes in the room, the only thing my ego did for me was try to kill me. And actually, you know, Jesus says in the Course, you know, the ego wants you dead. But what he really means by that is that if I live in this world of form and I believe that this world of form is my truth, then I am not alive. You know, this character is not a living thing. Nothing in the world is a living thing because there is no life outside of heaven. So I'm not even alive in this world as this ego character. And the ego likes it that way to keep me the walking dead, because as the walking dead, all I do is you know, go through the dream, and believe that it's what I am. I don't see the truth of what I am. And that's the ego's job, is to keep me from seeing the truth of what I am, because if I do, then it has no more job. It's done. And, you know, it's not trying to preserve itself because it's evil. It's because the purpose of the ego is to make the world seem real, mm-hmm. and to keep me involved in the dream. And when I no longer see the world as real or want to be involved in the dream, then the ego has no purpose.
Yeah. As Ken always likes to say, it's not evil, sinful, or wicked. It's just silly. It's just silly and forgivable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's done nothing. So, all right. Well, you know what? I really don't have much more to say, Bruce.
I think we've covered quite a bit of ground, actually.
I think we have too.
Thank you so much, Lynn, as always, and thanks to all the listeners and anyone else who is contributing, and thanks also to everyone at the Foundation for Inner Peace and Foundation for A Course in Miracles, and we've drawn heavily from both of those wonderful organizations this morning.
Exactly. And I'm going to actually forward to you the flyer for that.
Oh, please do. Please do. Yes.
Carolina Carota is coming to the States, and she's going to be going around in in San Francisco, I think, is one of the first places that she's going to be. You know, it looks like it's going to be really cool. And so I'm going to send you the flyer, and maybe you can post the link to the flyer or post it on your website or whatever. But it's September 18th at the Community Miracle Center, and I believe it's let me look and see if I can see the time here.
I think it's probably on their website too, so yeah.
No, it's not on their website.
Oh, okay.
I talked to Rep Tony, and he said that he doesn't put things like that on their website. So, so I'm going to put it on our website, our ACIM Gather, and, I'll send it to you and maybe you can, you know, post it, or at least, you know, let people know that it's happening.
Sure.
But yeah, Carolina's going to be at several different places in the States, but, so the 18th San Francisco. So okay. Are you still going to be in California? Yeah,
I will actually be en route this week from tomorrow. I'm hopping in a little minivan. I'm going to do a light move, and my wife and I are driving back to Colorado. So,
uh-huh.
A couple days, yeah. So, yep, back.
Very good. Well,
change of scene in the dream venue.
Exactly. You'll be home in time for winter.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. That's the way it goes. All right, sweetie. Well, thank you so much. And I think I'm going to put on a song before Devin and Barb start. And we'll talk to you next Saturday morning.
Thanks again.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye for now.